And we have an update on the Agland Discharge Program with Mr. Ben Zabinski.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Members of the board. My name is Ben Zabinski of your staff, and I'm going to give you an update today on the progress that we're making towards developing the Agricultural Lands Discharge Program. So the Aglands Discharge Program is a region-wide program to address the effects of agricultural lands on water quality. Staff have been working with a stakeholder advisory group since December of 2011 on the elements of the program. The last time I presented to you was in January of this year, and we've made a lot of progress since then. I want to say the advisory group's been very helpful in putting the program together. We've been able to consider the needs of the particular ag communities that we have in the North Coast region with their help. So I'm going to go into some detail on the purpose of the program, where we are with the stakeholder process, some of the ways they've helped us develop the program. And, one of the things that we've produced with the advisory group is a draft document that we put together that describes the scope and the framework of the program. And I brought some copies of that, too. And finally, I'll talk about the next steps. We're about a third of the way through this process at this point, and I'll give an overview of where we're headed. So the overall purpose of the program is in line with the purpose of our agency, and that's to protect and improve water quality in the North Coast region. Since it is a non-point source program we're developing, it's really going to focus on the implementation of management practices, and it's going to satisfy our state and federal mandates spelled out in the California Water Code and the Federal Clean Water Act, respectively. It will provide coverage for agricultural operations under these two sets of regulations, provided that they meet the program requirements. And finally, it will meet our obligations under the state non-point source policy developed by the State Water Board. And that policy directed the regional boards to develop regulatory coverage for all non-point source land uses in the state, and addressing agriculture is part of doing that. For example, we have other programs covering timber, dairies, and we're developing a program for county roads. So this is really another step towards our goal of covering all the different types of land use in our region that could affect water quality. So on this slide, I've highlighted some of the authorities for the California Water Code. And I'm sure you're familiar with this, the board is at least. First, California Water Code 13260 requires any person discharging waste to waters of the state to file an application for a permit with the Water Board, and that's called the Report of Waste Discharge. And currently, agricultural operations that discharge waste are obligated to file this application. And one of the functions of this program is to streamline that requirement for operations that have a discharge. So the next section that I want to highlight here, and this isn't comprehensive, but 13263 requires that the board adopt waste discharge requirements for discharges that are not otherwise waived. And then 13269 provides for that conditional waiver. So currently in developing the Aglands program, we're headed in the direction of a general conditional waiver that would be developed pursuant to 13269. And then finally, I want to mention 13267. That provides the authority for the executive officer to request technical reports for suspected discharges. And this is the basis for monitoring and reporting requirements that will be part of the program. So that's a quick overview of where our authority is coming from. And so before I get into the details, I want to go over the scope of the program in general and also some of the goals for the program. So in general, the program must cover discharges of waste to waters of the state and other controllable water quality factors associated with ag operations. So this has a limit implied in the program in that It will not cover water rights or other aspects of agriculture besides the effect on water quality. In terms of agricultural land uses, we're defining the scope through a list of the types of agricultural operations that will be included, and I'll provide that list in another slide. So for the operation to be in the program, it, number one, has to be on the list of types of operations that are covered, and number two, it needs to be discharging waste to waters of the state. So you need to meet both of those criteria. So the next two bullets kind of demonstrate this. For example, grazing on dry land, land that's not irrigated, that's not one of the named types of operations. So therefore, dry land grazing is not included. Likewise, an operation that would otherwise fall in the scope by being one of the named types would fall out of the scope if there's no discharge of waste to waters of the state, that being outside of our jurisdiction. That's the scope in general. And then here's some of the overall goals. First, in line with our purpose, we want the program to be protective of water quality while being reasonable to implement. It has to make sense on the ground. We want to prioritize the highest risk to water quality first. And the way we're going to approach this is by setting up, well, what we're proposing is the program be set up with tiers that correspond to risks to water quality, and that's how the implementation will be prioritized. So we also want the program to recognize ongoing efforts to protect water quality and not duplicate requirements. You know, again, I want to reiterate, a lot of this has been spoke about this morning, and just want to recognize, you know, all the ongoing efforts that have been being implemented for many years in this region. You know, there's a variety of existing programs, and people have done a lot of good work in to address water quality. And we definitely recognize that. So where there is an existing program or plan that can meet requirements, really there's no need to create another program that does the same thing. So this is where the advisory group has been helpful, and they've been able to describe some of the existing programs in our region. Finally, the program needs a feedback mechanism so we can report to the board. It will include a periodic review. We want to really be able to pull on meaningful monitoring and reporting information that's collected by staff and the operators so you all can make informed decisions about the future of the program. So that's the adaptive management idea. So we've been very fortunate to work with an excellent advisory group as we're developing the program. They've been extremely helpful in providing input on what the program needs to accomplish and what can be reasonably expected in terms of implementation. Again, we had our first meeting in December of 2011. We've also been fortunate to contract with the Sacramento State University Center for Collaborative Policy, and they're serving as the group facilitator. And we feel that this group adequately represents the range of stakeholder interests and agricultural communities present in the North Coast region. The group meets as both a full group and then in four separate subgroups that are based on geography. And this slide shows the four different areas represented by the subgroups. And having these subgroups really allows the advisory group to focus on the local conditions and then bring those findings back to the larger group. And this way we've had a lot of good exchanges of information. And it's made the program better at being able to, the development of it, to maintain some consistency across the region and also be flexible to take into account some of these differences around the region. So here's a table showing the dates and the topics we've discussed. December 2011 was kind of an introduction to the goals of the program. Next, we held a round of meetings of the subgroups in February. That was more introductions and hearing about some of the local concerns. In April, we had another round of subgroup meetings, and that's where we first presented this draft scope and framework document. And this was at the request of the group to prepare this, something for them to comment on. So we took comments from that and came back with a revised draft in June 2012, which was a full group meeting. And the goal of that meeting was to really finalize that piece of the program and have that as a working draft, kind of set that aside, and then start working on the other pieces of the program. So we were able to do that, and that went out in September to the group, and we have a draft final document, I guess, at this point. We're kind of putting it on hold. And I'm going to go over what's in that document. And again, just I want to express my gratitude to the advisory group. You know, these meetings have gone very well. They've been very professional and respectful, and we're very appreciative of that, definitely. So this document is an outline of the scope and framework of the program. So talk about the scope. And so this is the list of ag operations that will be included in the scope. So it's if it's not in the list, it's not in the scope. So you can see, you know, these are the types of agriculture that are present in the North Coast region. We have row crops here. We have vineyards, orchards, where we have pasture and forage crops in the program, proposing that they be in the program, but only if they discharge tailwater. We have medicinal marijuana operations and wholesale nurseries and greenhouses. So once the operation falls in the scope, we are further refining it to, you know, we're only including the acreage where the crops are produced and also certain associated facilities on the property. So it's not the entire property that is covered by the program, by the waiver. So an example of an associated, well, obviously the production area is where the crops grow. And then associated facilities would include, you know, roads and animal feeding areas. There's a list of, there will be a list of associated facilities to clarify that. And I also want to point out that an ag operation includes both the covered acreage and the activities that take place on that acreage. Okay, so these are the operations that are specifically not included. First, there's an overall threshold for inclusion in the program that we're proposing, and that's a minimum acreage of 5 acres. And we had a lot of discussion about this with the advisory group, many of the group members stating that size is not necessarily a good gauge of risk to water quality, and correctly noting that, you know, even operations less than 5 acres could have a potential for large impacts. However, we're still sticking with this and proposing it as a minimum acreage because we really need to provide a floor for the program. For example, we don't want to include people's backyard vegetable gardens in the program. We really need to draw the line somewhere. And 5 acres is a good number because it'll cover the vast majority of agricultural acreage in the region. And then on top of that, there's the caveat that, you know, if there is a particular operation that's smaller, that's creating a problem, we always have the ability to put it into the program if we need to, regardless of its size. So that's the direction we're headed with that. Some other operations that are excluded, for example, would be the Future Farmers of America, 4-H Club projects, academic research projects. As I mentioned before, dryland grazing is not one of the named land uses. Definitely have had a lot of concerns about that or misunderstandings about that. And also pasture and forage crops without tailwater are not included. And then at the bottom there, I've noted that, you know, 5 acres is probably not the right threshold for medicinal marijuana. A lot of times they're smaller than that. So we're still working on what the right size threshold for that is. Okay, so again, the program is focused on controlling discharges of waste to waters of the state and other controllable factors. So on this slide, I have a list of some of the types of waste that might be associated with an ag operation to give you an idea of some of the types of water quality issues addressed. So just to read the list, sediment, nutrients, pathogens, pesticides, organic matter, fertilizer, and then impacts to the riparian area being a controllable water quality factor. So this is a pretty comprehensive list, but nothing too unfamiliar there. So Basically, these wastes can be delivered to surface waters through runoff and infiltration of groundwater. And so the program will require the implementation of management practices to reduce the amount of waste in agricultural runoff. And so here's a list of the types of runoff that the program will consider. Tailwater, stormwater runoff, runoff from roads, subsurface drainage water, tile drain water, frost protection water runoff, and also infiltration to groundwater. So that's just to give an idea of, you know, how are the wastes delivered to waters? You know, what are we going to be looking at? What are the management areas that are of concern? And of course, this will vary by operation whether or not these are a concern. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so that's the program scope. So I'll switch to the other part of the document, the scope and framework document, the framework. And this is, again, the advisory group's been very helpful with this. The group was in favor of basing the program on risk to water quality, and we're proposing three tiers that are tied to risk. The first two tiers would fall under the general conditional waiver, and the third tier would be for operations that would be assigned waste discharge requirements. So there are two categories within Tier 1. There's a tier for operations that pose a low risk to water quality based on the physical characteristics of their operation and location. And there's also a water quality stewardship category, as we're calling it, based on addressing risks through effective management. And these categories were developed with input from the advisory group that there should be two pathways into Tier 1, and that operators shouldn't be prevented from reaching Tier 1 based just on their physical conditions. You need to account for good management. So that's why we have these two categories in there. And then Tier 2 is for operations that basically don't fall into Tier 1 or Tier 3. And Tier 3 is for operators that either choose not to obtain coverage under the waiver, or for an operation that there's a significant enough risk to water quality that it's more appropriate to regulate that under an individual permit. So those are the program tiers. Okay, so I'm going to talk about each tier, and I want to go over some basic concepts of the program. First of all, again, this is a BMP-based program. It relies on operators to select practices that are appropriate for their operations and that are also effective at addressing risks. The program will have performance standards that the practices must meet, and these standards will be the same for all tiers. And these standards, I can make a reference to what was in the Scott TMDL waiver and that list of guidance in there. We're going to try and be as consistent with that as possible. So the standards will be the same for all the tiers. So the difference between the tiers is in the monitoring and reporting requirements and in the inspection priority and where staff focuses. So Tier 1, the benefits of being in Tier 1 is that there will be fewer monitoring and reporting requirements and also a lower priority for staff inspections due to the fact that there is either an inherently low risk of the operation or that we have assurance that management practices are in place and are effective. So it doesn't require as much attention. So quickly going through the tiers, this low risk tier has some easily identifiable eligibility criteria that correspond to risk. For an operation to qualify, there must be no runoff from the operation to surface waters, except for stormwater runoff. Obviously, everybody has that. So this means no discharges of tailwater, drainage water, or any other discharge that isn't the result of precipitation. No use of certain pesticides. Again, this is just for Tier 1. This isn't for the entire program. Minimal direct runoff from roads to surface water. The production land, the covered acreage must be on less than a certain slope. There has to be sufficient protection of riparian and buffers provided to filter stormwater. with these criteria, we're really trying to ensure that there's a low risk and that it doesn't really require as much attention from our staff. So recognizing that operations, you know, just based on where they are may not meet this low risk category or just the nature of their, the way that they're running their operation, but they also may not pose a significant risk to water quality because some of those risks are being managed. We're proposing this other means to qualify for Tier 1 through the water quality stewardship category. So to provide, you know, we don't have this completely fleshed out, but the idea is that to qualify for Tier 1, this part of Tier 1, this category, the operator must provide assurances to the regional board that their management practices are sufficient to mitigate any of the risks. So we're proposing that this assurance be provided by having a water quality management plan that is approved by the regional board's executive officer and by verifying that management practices have been implemented and are effective. And we're going to refine these requirements later in the development process, working with the advisory group. We just wanted to get these concepts down for this tier. And I also want to mention that we're going to be providing options for developing management plans. This doesn't mean an individual plan necessarily. Okay, so, you know, an individual, they can develop a plan on their own. You know, we're planning on perhaps providing a template to develop your plan. I heard somebody mention, I think it was Marsha, that was mentioning a checklist that has been used before, something of that nature. Plans can be developed by a group of operators or a third-party program, and then, of course, they need to be adapted to the individual operation. So also, one of the roles of the third party could be to verify on the ground that the practices have been implemented and are effective. So the second piece of meeting this category, a lot of these third-party programs have independent auditors and could play the role of inspecting the operation to make sure that the practices are there and they're effective. So at the next round of advisory group meetings, we have meetings coming up in a couple weeks now, these subgroup meetings, we're going to be talking about planning options in particular. Tier 2, in short, Tier 2 operations are those that do not meet the Tier 1 criteria. So it means they don't meet at least one of the Tier 1 low-risk criteria, and it means that they're either not implementing an approved plan or have not had their plan certified, and their management practices are not yet verified. So operators in Tier 2 must still develop a management plan and implement practices, but the difference that the plan has not been approved and there are either unresolved water quality problems or the practices haven't been verified. Again, we still need to flesh out exactly what the requirements will be for these tiers. But the overall idea is that there's still some work to be done in Tier 2. You're on your way, and that once you have your verification and your approval, then you would move into Tier 1, where there would be less reporting requirements and what I was explaining before. So, and a higher priority for inspections in Tier 2. Just hit that last bullet. Okay, so that's what we have so far for the draft scope and framework of the program. Again, this is all on a document that we've developed and worked with the advisory group, it exists on paper. And so we're going to start focusing on the other pieces of the program. So we may need to come back and revisit some of these scope and framework elements. Once we've worked out more of the program, we'll have a better perspective on, you know, maybe we need to make some changes. So it's not a done deal. Okay, so the schedule for finishing the development of the program is not on this slide. It is, where are we here?
Next slide.
Okay, wait, no, I do want to talk about these meetings coming up. These are the upcoming meetings. So there is one here in Wairika And that's on October 24th. So at these meetings, we're going to present a draft of some of the requirements that would go into the conditional waiver. So the requirements would be both performance standards and prohibitions that would be met through, again, the implementation of practices. So some of the permit language, that's what we want to focus on. And then the other part of the meeting is going to be looking at water quality plans, different ways plans can be developed, what existing plans there are or programs, ways that they can be developed. Again, I mentioned that, you know, they can be developed individually through a group, through a third-party program. And the other meetings are up here. The one in Yreka is at the Klamath National Forest Building. And then the Tule Lake Group is meeting in Klamath Falls at the Klamath Water Users Office. And we just sent out a notice of these meetings to the group. So here's the next steps. So we have our next round of subgroup meetings in October. And then after that, we're going to look at monitoring and reporting in January. And then by May of 2013, we hope to have a full draft waiver putting all the different pieces together into a permit format that then we would present to the group, get their input, revise that, and present that at another group meeting. You know, we really want the advisory group to have a look at the what the actual draft permit is before it goes out to the public. So I wanted to mention that, you know, this would complete our meetings, but I think Rebecca's going to talk to this a little bit more. We may need to add another meeting in here because we're finding that we're needing more time to really go through the different elements of the program. One of the things that's missing from here is enrollment and how that's going to work. So that may need to be a third subgroup meeting that's not on the schedule. So I think that's pretty much it. We're scheduled to go out for public review for August 2013 and then a hearing for December of 2013. Here's my contact information. We have a program website. You know, all the agendas and presentations and some of the meeting materials, it's all kind of laid out on the website, you know, each meeting, kind of how I had that other table. So there's definitely quite a bit of information on there, and it's updated regularly. And then there's also this LIRIS list, which is the email list. There's a way to subscribe for that. And that there, you can also get there through the program website, too. There's a link at the bottom. Do you want to?
No, you covered it, just the fact that
the schedule is a little.
This is Rebecca Fitzgerald, senior of the TMDL unit. Ben already covered what I was just going to throw in, and that we are considering putting in another subgroup meeting to just handle some of the enrollment process. Are we going to look at submission of any of this? Are plans going to stay on the ranch? There's a lot of interest in regards to that. And there are a few other issues we're also seeing that it takes us a little bit longer than we had originally planned to take into account all the wonderful comments that we're getting from our advisory group process, turn back new drafts for the members who want to see that, and then prepare materials for our next round of meetings. So the December 2013 day to get this before you for your consideration is looking a little bit tenuous at this point, so we just sort of wanted to give you a heads up on that, and we'll continue to fill you in as should and if the schedule change in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think talking to the subgroups has really been helpful, and as much of this as we can work out ahead of time and get a program that is reasonable and people can buy into, I mean, I think that's just going to help in the end, so.
Well, Ben, thank you very much, and Rebecca, too. Nice to see you, Rebecca, again. And you, too, Ben. It looks like the stakeholder advisory group has paid dividends. I mean, I went to the first meeting of that, and it was just kind of in its beginning formation and amalgamation. How's that worked for you guys through, looks like, maybe four or five sets of meetings at this point? Looks like you've got work product out of that. Have you retained the broad representation that you sought in the beginning of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have, most of the people have, yeah, we've had pretty good participation, I would say. People have come back. I mean, we have lost a couple of members maybe, and we may end up adding a couple more. But overall, yeah, people have been attending, and we've been able to fill people in, you know, when they miss a meeting. And had a lot of side conversations and phone calls with people to work things out. So it's been going pretty well.
You know, the other thing is I mean, sometimes it pays to go second, or maybe third sometimes even, you know. I know that some of the other regional boards, Region 5, Region 3, I think, mm-hmm. I believe Region 2 has gone down this road. If not all the way, then they're going down this road. Yeah. What have you seen, Ben, from their actions out there, not only maybe finished product, but process? How are they regional? And the questions I have specifically is like regional differentiation, just between, we have a region that is everything from, you know, grape intensive in the south to row crops and you know, forage crops in the north and everything in between. And, you know, that's a pretty broad universe to capture out there.
Yeah, and again, that's the benefit of the subgroups. And, you know, I have been looking, I think... Each region's ag programs, you know, we have a little bit of each of them. So, you know, in Region 3 and Region 5, they're really dealing with the row crops and the more intense, I guess, agricultural land uses, as opposed to the San Francisco Bay region that is working on a vineyards program, and they also have their grazing program. So I guess if you put them all together, it covers what we have in our region. You know... And I would say that in our region, there's a little bit less concern with toxicity as opposed to other regions, so that kind of differentiates us in what the needs for monitoring are going to be and our approach to monitoring. I think that's going to be quite a bit different than, say, in the Region 3 and Region 5, Central Valley and Central Coast. I really like some of the models that... they have in Region 2 with the grazing program in Tomales Bay. I think that they developed a template for a farm plan with UC Davis, and it's very simple. You know, it's not very long, and I think that serves as a good model of what, you know, as we were talking about earlier today. And I think, you know, Heidi was mentioning that the plan doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be a long plan, but planning is a good idea. And, that's definitely not our intent, to make something cumbersome, and we just needs to address what it needs to address. It doesn't have to be fancy.
Can I ask you, so, Ben, the stewardship, you know, we kick around the word stewardship, and truly to me, stewardship is a recognition of a land ethic and a practice out there, and actually in some regulatory form of process that we go through making regulations and applying them, trying to fit stewardship into that. A recognition, maybe a stewardship, and that's kind of my take on it, right? That stewardship, I think of people that have land long term or maybe even short term that do great things with it and have really high quality land, and that to me has all kinds of elements into it, including ethic and land use and all that kind of stuff. Is the stewardship tier as it's now set up? It seems like this is somewhat slicing out to where, like, the dairy program kind of sliced out a little bit. It's almost an incentivization,
yes,
to get to that lightest touch and lowest regulatory level. The thing is, I imagine we're going to run into the fee word here, right? We're going to run into fees again on this.
Right.
Has there been much discussion within that stakeholder group of fees and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that has definitely come up, and there's been discussion of that. It's a concern. I guess I can explain a little bit how it works compared to a TMDL program versus an agricultural lands program, where the fee is required. I think that the state board is making a differentiation there between, you know, obviously a TMDL waiver covers more than just agriculture. And I was going to mention in my presentation that We would like, ideally, again, you know, as you mentioned, we don't really have control over this since the fees are generated at the state board. But ideally, we would like to have that incentive built into Tier 1 and to have a reduced fee for that tier as opposed to the other tier to incentivize that. I think there are issues with the tiers. There's like a fairness issue. It's based on acreage. And, you know, there's higher value crops. Some operations use a lot more acreage, but, you know, not as high value crops. So I think there is an equity issue there. So I don't know if you want to say something about the state and working with the state board at all. But there is an opportunity, and I think they are looking at the fees based on some of those fairness issues at looking at revising it.
Well, again, to me, our regulations are not oftentimes to me set up to reward. And if we could turn that corner,
yes,
though, somehow, we did it somehow in the dairy program. To me, it just worked that way. And I think the response, I know we don't necessarily have all this control, but at the same time, the response to that, I think is tremendous. I think it's a small thing,
right,
but it's a huge thing. I think to recognize people for their good effort out there is a super important part of regulation for me anyway. To be able to say, yeah, I recognize that, and I, you know, we're good.
Yeah, and I think there's a good argument for that because if, again, you have a lower inspection priority and less reporting, then that's not taking up as much staff time, then that is a logical argument for not charging as high of a fee.
You want to weigh in on that one?
I want to jump in the middle of this because it's one of the things that several of us have talked about is putting together two programs in order to kill two ducks with one brick. And sorry about that, bad analogy.
Yeah.
I apologize to David Leland. I wouldn't hurt one of his birds for the world.
Yeah.
The problem, if I'm correct, your ag program would actually require a ranch or a plan.
Yes.
Correct? And if you try and put that together with the waiver for Scott and Shasta,
yes,
where there is none unless it's required by the EO, it would make it very difficult to interface those two things because the same landowner could easily have a waiver under the Scott or Shasta TMDL,
mm-hmm,
and deal with agriculture, in which case we're saying on the one hand you don't have to have a ranch plan unless the EO requires it, but in order to meet this you do have to have a ranch plan.
Yeah, well, I don't, yeah, okay, yeah, sure,
sorry about this. It's a very good question, Mr. Massey, and we're definitely have been considering how the three programs will work together, and right now we are looking at a proposal that would involve the regional waiver being applicable to everybody except the Scott and the Shasta, at least in the next five or up to the next 5 years. And then where that's one option, I guess I want to say. Another option would be then to have this supersede the Scott and the Shasta. We're still playing with these different options. But the last thing that we want to do is have two ag type waivers being applied to the landowners in these two watersheds. So we will avoid that.
Okay. And if I could add something, staff council, setting aside the fee issue, another alternative is to have, I think Ben mentioned that everybody having a plan is not the only way direction that we can go in tier two. And so there could be a group effort, and something that, like the Shasta or Scott that's already up and running, could qualify as a group plan. And in the context, mm-hmm, of that group, you have your prioritization scheme. So I think it could fit in, although the fee issue is making that more difficult for us.
It's certainly gonna confuse the fee issue at one level. And I think the other thing is just in terms of the perception of us as a board, where we can amalgamate this stuff. You know, one of the hues and cries you get out of the public is that you get independent, separate agencies that all want to have the same thing, and we certainly piggyback on Department of Fish and Wildlife now, they are. And we use timber harvest plans. We use a lot of stuff. And so to the extent that we can bundle it together for the public, I think both a perception of us, but also, frankly, in terms of if it were me, I would say, yeah, come on, give me something that I can do. I do one thing, and it makes both your programs happy.
We agree.
Any other comments or questions? Looks like you have a schedule then. It looks like you have a potential schedule that runs this out. And by the way, I totally realize it's a process of discovery and iteration here as you go through this. One last question, though. You mentioned third-party certification on some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Have you identified anybody out there, groups that could do that as an independent third party? Are you looking at that kind of bend already?
Okay.
Got to move the microphone.
Yeah. Well, maybe we need to have a fourth subgroup meeting. But I think the plan for that is, well, we need to come up with criteria for what will qualify as a third-party program. But to answer your question, there are definitely potential candidates. We haven't, given the approval to any of them yet. And they're mostly in the vineyard industry that are up and running. So there's three of them, I think, that I can think of that could qualify. There's the fish-friendly farming program, there's the code of sustainable wine growing, and there's the sustainability in practice, I think, program. And they have their own, in the case of the latter two, they have an independent auditor that goes out, and they have a whole program plan, and there's actually different tiers in there as to what level they're at in terms of the level of management practices that they have in place. So the way that we could interact with that, and we've been working with them a little bit so far on which tier in their program would meet, where do the people in their program need to be in order to satisfy our requirements, and have our requirements match up with one of their tiers, so they could say, well, if you're in tier three in this program, then you qualify for meeting the waiver through this program. So that's, we're trying to those two consistent.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think also a third-party certification, often you can see it from things like timber. There's some timber out there that has Forest Stewardship Council stamp on it. In fact, some people market that, right? And some
mm-hmm.
people market, other things out there. I've seen some of the ag producers in our region actually that are, sophisticated enough to have market on, and put their image out there on websites. They'll have some of that.
And it's important, though,
because, again, I think it goes into the stewardship. It's a recognition of that work and certification.
Mm-hmm.
Get them through that process. Get them certified. In third party, if it's a trustful third party and we could rely upon that
mm-hmm.
that would
mm-hmm.
potentially be a good win.
Right,
and
that's what we need to work on. Yes.
Just to add, this is Matt St. John, that this is exactly the type of thing that the Klamath tracking and accounting program can allow for, is some prioritization and then a certification for exactly these type of programs that are doing work, can get certified through ClamTap, and then different both producers and creditors can get credit for that work.
All right, Mr. St. John, you gave me my in, because I should have done this before, because I meant to bring Clayton up before I started to go that direction, and I didn't. But Clayton, can I ask you to maybe just join us for a minute? We're just talking here, but the Klamath component to this thing, especially up in this area, is an important component, and you are in the center of a lot of things, I understand.
Well, I don't know if that's the best. Clayton Krager, your staff for Klamath TMDL implementation lead, staff scientist. This is an important part of our evolving program, is that we've heard many comments today about what have we been doing and what has been the impact. And that's actually adaptive management. And it's so important in the Klamath Basin, because almost all of our sub-basins are TMDL listed waters.
Right.
And so the attempt to develop and build ClamTap, and we have a 319H grant with the Klamath Watershed Partnership. They're registering pilot projects in the Sprague and the Williamson. to begin implementing Klamath tracking accounting program up there. We have a proposal from the Shasta RCD. Their board has voted to proceed with a 319 grant to begin implementing Klamath tracking accounting for the Shasta. The Shasta, as you might recall, is our stewardship, our initial stewardship watershed in terms of the watershed stewardship approach. And the Shasta RCD is our lead entity for that. So we're a collaborator with the Shasta RCD in that. And where the Klamath Tracking Accounting Program has relevance is it's the input to adaptive management. You track, verify, and certify projects so that you know what your management input is to the system. What do we expect in terms of a temperature reduction? What do we expect in terms of nitrogen or phosphorus reduction? And then we have the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program on the back end looking at, did we get what we expected? Are we monitoring a positive impact from these management actions? And if not, that's adaptive management. You come back and you revise and update your management approach. So that's, and if certainly in this area, having a third-party certification other than the regional board to certify those actions. The waivers are the baseline. We need the waivers. They're the regulatory tool. But there are many pathways to satisfy those waivers, and we're hoping that the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, which someday that name might have to be revised because it'll be covering a pretty broad area, but we have plans for it, and it's underway. And I know it sounds odd that we have a 319H grant in Klamath and up in the Klamath Basin, but that's, as you recall, where the big loads are, and we're already seeing benefits from that. An example is we just completed a nutrient mass balance for the inputs to Upper Klamath Lake. And for those, the Wood, the Sprague, and the Williamson, and for those tributaries where TMDL non-point source has been implemented and being tracked by the Klamath Watershed Partnership, we're seeing declines in the input concentrations to the lake, significant decreases in the incoming concentrations. Now, for Upper Klamath Lake, remember, a big part of their loading problem is the internal nutrient cycling from the sediments, so that we're only taming one part of the beast there, but we're making progress, and we need to be able to, the public needs to know, what did you do, and what did we get for it? And so that's why we're trying to build both sides of that, Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, and we're also, both boards are working together because they realize how well integrated their operations have to be. So it won't be two separate entities. We're working towards collaboration and integration of those two entities already. So we're trying to stay ahead of the curve here.
Well, you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. You know, the thing is that that's kind of what you're trying to do on this scale, right? And I mean, in reality, you know, the egg program is going to be, you know, as are TMDL, as are some of the other up and running programs, whether they be here or Oregon, is really going to be the cumulative work that starts to turn, you know, and starts to have that effect.
So earlier, this relates to this a little bit in that you asked about, Andy, about the monitoring program for the Shasta, and the reason why we are building this concept of both the tracking and accounting and the K-bump type approach, the coordinated monitoring approach to the Shasta monitoring plan, and it's more work because we need the involvement and collaboration of all the entities that are monitoring in the Shasta Basin. We don't have the resources to implement a monitoring program, so therefore we are working with other entities through the Shasta RCD to identify what their management actions are, where they want to implement them, where do they currently have monitoring stations, what are the rationale, analytical procedures, sampling protocols, so that we can optimize that network to work together as we're trying to translate the success we had in the Klamath Basin, the Klamath River, to the Shasta, and so the Shasta RCD is our lead on that as well. But Andy and I and others from the region, David Kuzmar, are working with them to develop that monitoring plan, but it's a component of a stewardship approach. because that's going to inform our actions that go into the adaptive management process. So you can't just pluck it out. It's part of the process.
I'm really glad I got you back up here. Thank you very much for that. I very much appreciate that perspective. Okay, so let me make some room here. There, I do have one speaker card. If there's anybody else that would like to speak to this issue, just fill one out. Felice, please.
My name is Felice Pace. I'm on the advisory committee. I represent the Sierra Club North Group there and Klamath Forest Alliance. You know, we've been engaged in the environmental community in a 30-year effort to get the Clean Water Act applied to Nod Point. We're 20 years in this region into it, starting with the TMDL lawsuits. Now we're at the stage where the rubber hits the road. We're going to judge it based on whether it's going to be effective. We are not about to accept something that's not going to be effective. Bottom line, this is where the rubber hits the road. There is no room for an ineffective program. We're pretty far from consensus. The staff had hoped to get consensus. They didn't talk about that today, so maybe they've given up on that. But we're pretty far from it. Ben started off saying we're taking care of ag. That's what I've heard all day today. I don't hear anybody talking about taking care of the public trust. I hear people talking about taking care of ag, and that reflects the board. That reflects what you said today. That reflects what you said. It reflects the message that the staff is getting from the board, that the public trust is secondary to taking care of the discharger. I think you need to examine that in terms of your obligations and what you took on when you accepted and did your swearing in. How long do we need to wait for restoration of our beneficial uses? How long? You know, we're not recovering. We're getting more listed watersheds. For one thing, a couple of things specifically on the presentation. One, the water right. This program needs to verify that the person is in compliance with their water right because there's a relationship between quantity and quality. So that can't be dodged the way they want to dodge it. In the wintertime, there's a 1 CFS stock water right in the Scott Valley, most of the Scott Valley. There's several irrigators who run their ditches full and irrigate year-round. Question. Why are all these great efforts that we keep hearing about not rezoning and attainment of water quality standards? If we're all doing great efforts, I admit there are great efforts out there, and you heard some of them, but you never hear about the non-great efforts. Ag operations are unitary. This is actually an ag point, not an environmental point. There's no justification for limiting the scope further than that. An ag operation needs to be evaluated. Multiple permits for a single operation is bad for the operation, it's bad for the budget, and you know it kind of renders, when the staff proposes multiple permits for a single operation, bifurcating and separating into grazing, this is your grazing operation, you need one permit for that, this is your irrigated crops, one permit for that, one permit for this and that. That's bad, you know, that. And it renders their assertions that they don't have time to do this and don't have time to do that. Well, this is where you save the time. Let's have one permit for one ag operation. And I think, you know, ag people, I don't know for sure, but I think ag people will support that. This 5-acre minimum, the staff proposed first a 1-acre minimum. Now 5 acres is okay. What's the objective basis for that? You know, we've told them, the ag people, I was sat in this room, I think it was this room, with the ag people and told them, you know, that the size of the operation is irrelevant. I could take you out and show you a feeding operation next to a creek that's like 1 acre, but it trashes the creek. You know, it trashes the creek. There's no grass there. There's no riparian. It's right. They use the creek for feeding. And it's small. I mean, here's guys sitting out in this place that got huge operations that don't impact the watershed like that guy does. So, you know, all these have been recommendations and observations have already been given to staff. Irrigated row crops, if there's no discharge, well, then you're not in the program. Well, you know, I can show you this too, and you probably know it. You know, unless you have a tailwater recovery program, you know, with a berm and infiltration or repumping and that stuff, then I could have no discharge now. I'm just going to tell you I have no discharge because I can have no discharge, but I can put on too much water and have a discharge next year when you're not there. So, you know, that just doesn't make sense to me.
Hey, Felice, can I ask you to finish?
Yeah, I'll wrap up. Sure. And I'm addressing only those questions which were specifically in.
It's okay.
Key question is how can one determine risk and whether there is a potential for a discharge? As far as I can tell from studying this and going to all these meetings, we can take the landowner's word for it or we can evaluate the operation. So what we have proposed is that as long as it takes, you start with the highest risk. We support tiering in terms of evaluation. You look at the highest risk first, and you evaluate those. But eventually, depending on your staff resources, you get to evaluate all operations because that's the only way other than taking somebody's word for it. If there's another way, I'd like to know what it is. In a BMP program, I'm almost done, okay? 2 points. BMP program, to work, there must be robust public education. By the way, I'm a lifetime credentialed teacher. I have a Master of Arts in Education. I'm not talking off the top of my head, I ran drug and alcohol education and prevention for this county and other counties. Third-party certification. Any third-party certification only works if you have a robust quality assurance program. So far, staff has refused to put it in, even though it's been recommended. That means staff has to pull a random sample of those every year and check to see. Because, you know, these third-party fish certifications, they don't even address, and the people that implement them don't have water quality expertise necessarily. Okay, that's about it.
Can I? I'm sorry, go ahead. No, please.
I just want you to know that I hear you on the five-acre thing. It's something that I was thinking about as they were presenting. We have situations in our community where you have a five-acre bulb farm that runs right up to the river's edge. And it has discharges.
Yeah.
We also have situations where we have 2 or 3 acres medical marijuana plantations where there's no runoff right now, but once they pull the plants, dump all the fresh potting soil and all the nitrogen that's been input out on the ground and the first rain happens, you have a runoff experience.
Right.
So it is going to be a challenge, as Ben suggested, saying how do we keep someone's backyard garden, which I have and love, from being in that situation, but then also being able to, you know, kind of go down the list and go, okay, well, this is a different situation. And I think that's where best management practices are going to come into play and where the ability for the staff to, and I think Ben mentioned this, to say, well, there are going to be caveats. There are going to be variables that come into play. Yes, you're under 5 acres, but we have, you know, suspicion or we believe or we have evidence that there was a discharge by your less than 5 acre property. We have farmers market gardeners that are able to make a full living on 5 acres, and then they rent the 5 acres next to them that belong to somebody else. So one person's running a 10 acre operation, but they're under 5 acres apiece. So how are you going to deal with that?
Yeah.
Those are all things that as we go through this process, we're going to have to learn, and we're going to have to go to those technical committees, get the feedback. They're going to have to, you know, Google Earth things and figure out how we're going to manage through that. It's a process. We're still in it. So help us and get the word out to anybody else, you know, to be able to make these hard decisions. But like Ben said, you have to have a bottom, because if you don't, then everybody's in there.
I agree, so, by the way, with the bottom. But some groups, some within the state, have used proximity to water. See, there are other criteria besides acreage. And what I don't understand is why we're still on acreage when there was really strong bipartisan, you know, ag environmental recommendation that acreage is not a good way to judge potential to impact.
Well, and your comments are duly noted, and we'll make sure that stays in the conversation.
Heidi, we're going to stay in there. You know, I mean, I do this as a volunteer. And we're going to stay in there. It's a burden, but we're going to hang in there to the end and try to get this thing. It's tremendously important. But this is, you know, I've personally been involved for 20, 25 years in trying to get to this point. So we really have to have something that is going to work.
Thanks, Felice. I do give you credit. You do show up. You are consistent. You are somebody that participates, and I do thank you for that. And your participation on this task force is important. Thank you very much. Jane Vorpa? Oh, I knew I was going to do it wrong. Sorry, Jane. Come on up, please. Oh, there's no oath. It's an informational item. We believe you. Come on up.
Hi, thank you, members of the board. I'm Jane Vorpagel, the water quality biologist for the former Department of Fish and Game. I just had a couple questions. I am the principal representative for Fish and Wildlife on this ag committee.
Check your paycheck, see what it says.
Yeah, I didn't get one yet. And I just had a question. Rebecca said something that got me a little bit confused. And so I think the question was brought up of how we're looking at how this will impact the Scott and Shasta waivers. And to me, it seems like we're asking the Scott and Shasta people to be in two programs. And I thought the ag, you know, I'm just asking for clarification because it seems like the Scott and Shasta people are doing these TMDL efforts, and I've been participating in those for many, many years. And now this ag program, it seems like if I were a farmer in the Scott and Shasta, I'd be concerned, okay, if I'm in this TMDL and I'm doing everything right for the TMDL, I don't have to pay a fee, and now here comes another ag program, and I'm going to have to pay a fee. And Rebecca said something about it something wouldn't happen with the TMDLs, but I didn't really understand what she said. So that's
how about we get Rebecca up and ask her back? She could just sit right beside you. She's really nice.
Virginia. I know Rebecca.
Bring this thing around again. So my main point in what I was trying to say is that we want to avoid a duplicative situation for the farmers out in the watersheds. We don't want them to be under the Scott and Shasta waiver simultaneously with then the regional ag program waiver. So it is confusing, and it's a challenge for us to try to figure out the best way in order to address that situation. Obviously, fees are a huge concern. There is no fee associated with the Scott and Shasta waivers that you just adopted, in part because of those are TMDL implementation waivers. They're not so explicitly ag program waivers, and we have a statewide fee that is applicable to irrigated lands through irrigated land waste discharge requirements and waivers of WDRs. So this program that we're currently working on for the whole region, we're trying to figure out the best way in order to bring in the Scott and the Shasta, perhaps in the long term.
Nothing said.
Sorry, Samantha. Into the regional program, but in the short term of the next 5 years, one option is to let the Scott and Shasta waivers you just adopted run their course and perhaps fold them into the regional program after that period of time. Does that help answer your question?
So the people in the Scott and Shasta would not have to participate in the ag program? Is that what you're saying?
They have their waiver for the next 5 years or up to the next 5 years. We are very much encouraging them to participate in the development of this ag program, and we have many representatives from those watersheds in our advisory group because there's the possibility that the larger ag program can apply to them in the future.
Okay, so then that alleviates my concern that I had with that.
No, I think that was a very good concern, Jane. Yeah. I think we have the same concerns about how this thing's going to, how it's going to run in parallel or mesh in that gear to get that done.
And we also are looking at how to best coordinate with our dairy program, with the Garcia Watershed TMDL, which has its own unique set of requirements for sediment control. With our timber program, with the U.S. Forest Service, not that there's much ag land on the U.S. Forest Service, but our other programs, we are very aware of the need to coordinate and make this as seamless as possible.
Okay, and then I just... I had one more question, I guess, or point for Ben. And this may be just a matter of me reading the newspaper or some news article instead of what really happened, but I noticed that, and I also started working on this ag program for Water Board Region 5 because I have three water boards that I work with. And I noticed that they were calling it the industrial or perhaps it was commercial agricultural program. And I don't know if that's a real difference or if Ben has looked at, you know, their program enough to realize what the differences are. Maybe it's just terminology, but I just wondered if that would get people who have backyard gardens out of the program if we're only looking at people that are actually making a profit off of what they're growing. And that's pretty
much
got
Mr. Ben up here now, and he's really nice too. He can sit right there.
There you go, Ben.
The moving of the microphone.
Yeah, well, you know, that is something that we considered. And as we discussed it in the advisory group, we were struggling with a way to verify that and a way to verify whether it's the value of your crops or the revenue. And having to verify that and get into people's financial information. Although I think in Region 3, I don't even, well, just maybe to crack the door a little, they used a tax form for commercial agriculture. So, I mean, I think maybe this is something that we can revisit. I mean, that may be a simpler way to do it, to show that you're filing the certain tax form that you're
unless
a commercial
you're a
operation.
Marijuana
but there's probably, there may be problems with that too. So. We did consider that, but it seemed like it was too difficult to verify. And that is the reason, one of the reasons for going with the acreage, is that it is something that we can just easily verify, and it's, you're either in or out of the program. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it's in the mix, though. It sounds like both these things are in the mix and
yes.
being thought of and discussed.
Yes.
It doesn't sound to me like any decisions have been made hard and fast about how
definitely
this goes,
not.
And we're kind of knee-deep in the big muddy, and it sounds like, well, sometimes it's good to go second and sometimes it's not so good to go second because you're trying to jive this and make this work in a regional basis with things that are already in play, and there's expectations and programs running, so
right.
it's not going to necessarily be easy. You bring up very good points, Jane.
Yes.
And then I just wanted to...
There you go.
Just kind of to address one of Felice's comments is... You know, the different subgroups went around and around on the acreage, 1 acre or 5 acre. And I know that one of my comments, I was one of the voices that spoke up and said that if we go to 1 acre, it's really going to be almost extremely impossible for board staff to even try and get a handle on something that's a 1 acre, and that the board has the power. If we see a real bad actor and a bad character on a 1 acre parcel, the board does have other avenues that they can use to control those waste discharges. And so that's why I'd still support the, I mean, maybe not, I mean, if we have to go with acres, I'd support the larger acres just because of the workload.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, John Corbett is usually the one that speaks up to reserve our right for any other discretionary decisions that we can make. And I would just say that that's the case here as well. Regardless of size, if there's a discharge, it is subject to regs.
And I do appreciate the board. I understand I've been in this business for an awful long time, and regulating agriculture has always been the last kind of, I don't know how I want to say it, but it's been difficult. And so I appreciate the board's attempts, and anything
you,
I can do to help is I'll be glad to do.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I have one last speaker card for Marsha Armstrong. Thanks, Ben.
Marsha Armstrong, Board of Supervisors. One of the issues was, as you were talking about the acreage, I'm assuming it's the acreage cultivated, because in Siskiyou County, on septic systems, we don't have an acre, you know, you have to have a minimum of 5 acres for a septic system. So that would include everybody. So, the other is, it seems, with the tailwater issue, I think we're going to have a problem with flood irrigation. This is going to be a disincentive for flood irrigation. And as I said, we're trying to increase that retention of water, and we're looking at whether these super efficient systems are actually not working against our ability to retain water later into the summer. And perhaps some of our flood irrigation systems, with that recharge of the water profile and then the slow eking into the stream, is what is actually used to be feeding some of the stream, and now it's so super efficient we're not getting any. So that may be a problem. And then the other is the fees, mentioning the fees on a per acreage basis. In our area with irrigated pasture, it takes a lot more land in order to support cow-calf production or sheep production than it does for row crops up in the upper Klamath. So there is an equity issue there.
All great points, Marcia.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have no other speaker cards for this issue. This is an informational item. I would just say that we look forward to seeing what happens in the future. You've got a process in play. You've got participating people engaged in a stakeholder process, and we'll look to see how that goes. The one question I had, if I get you just answer this on mic, Ben, is, so when do you come before us again? And because I see a kind of a I see your runway here, but I don't see us included in that, except at the very end. And just wondering, is there another update you have for us at some point in the future anticipated?
Absolutely. I've been planning to do updates to you about every 6 months on this program. So
six months
from now.
Okay, it's a date. We'll get you on the calendar. I very much appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, good work. I really appreciate you coming and bringing us up to speed on this. Keep going.
There's a lot to chew on.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to
you.
You
guys want to help take a bite off? We'd appreciate it.
Okay. You bet.
Join us. All right.
Thank you very much. Okay. The only item I have left